So for example, we have the crown chakra here at the top of the head. So on earth, the crown chakra is Mount Kailash. And even people who are living in South America, the shamans, they also believe that they are at the tail end of the kundalini of earth, and Kailash is as the is the head end, the crown chakra. The root chakra is in Mount Shasta in California. All the mystics, they believe that.
Namaste, Swamiji.
Namaste, Sujata ji.
So, welcome to Cafe Rainy Days. We are very lucky to have Swami Mahesh with us. Swamiji is also known as Wandering Mahesh. He's the founder of CI International, through which he teaches various yogic activities. Swamiji's guru, Swami Satyananda Saraswati ji, he's a disciple of Satyananda Saraswati. Swami has traveled all around the world teaching yoga sadhana. He also organizes retreats in certain very high energy centers such as Peru, Tibet, Iceland, Kailas Mansarovar. And by background, Swamiji is an engineer. So over to you, Swamiji. How did this engineer become a Swami?
Well, Sujata ji, I had some psychic experiences early on in my childhood. And at that time, I had no idea about all those experiences. But when those experiences became very strong in when I was in high school, and this is when my mind started searching for answers. And I had to wait to find my right guru. And then it took some time. So in that meantime, I just finished my engineering. And after that, when the path opened up, I was with my guru, Swami Satyananji Maharaj. He's a direct disciple of Swami Shivananji of Rishikesh. So yoga became a wonderful tool for me to understand and learn all the process of dealing with those psychic experiences, and also to look into something higher, something I would say more beautiful than what our senses can experience.
What sort of psychic experiences were these, Swamiji?
Some were challenging, some were very funny and interesting. So like early on in childhood, I had an out-of-body experience when I was 5 years old. And I was running high fever for a few days, very high fever. And I could feel that I am sitting somewhere on the ceiling while the body is getting treated by the doctor and my parents are taking care of it. So that made me think, but I was very young in age, so I could not understand much about it. I started reading books like Amar Chitra Katha and other mythological books when I was in high school. It was very funny because I had kind of a vision of what question paper, what kind of questions they'll ask us in a physics exam. And I mentioned it to my friend in the evening that I think these questions are very important and I feel that we should study from this sequence. And then he laughed off, and then next day in the exam, the question paper was exactly in the same sequence. So my mind started wondering that how did I know something before it actually happened? How could I see? So I scored good marks in physics. But what put me into the thinking mode was, what is the faculty in our body or mind or somewhere in consciousness that is able to travel in time and space freely? So that search really led me to the path of yoga.
So Swamiji, was there, for you to have had such experiences at such a young age, there must have been something happening in your previous lives. Not everybody sort of has these experiences at such a young age, or even after so much of sadhana, you know.
I believe so, because at one point in my own meditation, I could see my past life that I was living in Rishikesh. And I left my body at a very old age in Ganga. So I took Jal Samadhi. So that experience through meditation showed me a glimpse of my past life. So that means I must have been a sadhak, that this spiritual and the yogic path opened up spontaneously in my life. And although I can say I did not do much effort in this life, but definitely in my past lives, there must have been those accumulated samskaras and karmas that brought me to this path and to a wonderful guru in my life.
Did you always know that Satyananda ji is your guru, and how did that happen? How did you get led to your guru?
So when I was in high school and with all these experiences and the search, so I could not see my guru clearly, but I could see that there's some person who is wearing geru, the traditional dress of the sadhus in India, and he's always there to support me. He's holding me by my hand and guiding me. So when the experiences became stronger, I felt that he's there, but I could not see his face. When I was in my second year of college, and that's when I connected to yoga in a formal way with a yoga ashram in Raipur. And on the very first day, the Swami who was in charge there, he asked me if I could stay for another 20 minutes after class and do some karma yoga. And I had no idea of yoga philosophy or karma yoga. I said, well, I can help you in whatever you ask. And he asked me to unpack the books that he had received from Bihar School of Yoga. So they were wrapped in this paper, and I had to just check the inventory of the books received against the order. So when I opened the very first packet, the wrapper, on that I saw a picture of Swami Satyananda. And the catalog listing was of a Kundalini Tantra book. So there was mention of nadis and chakras and Kundalini, and I felt this person is talking to me. And everything, every word that is written in that catalog listing, it makes sense to me because he has led me through that experience. So I felt that this is my guru. And then it just opened up the path.
You knew there and then that this is it. He's the one.
Yes.
When I was in retreat with you, you were telling us of how it wasn't as if you knew this is the guru and you found him. It was quite a process. Tell us that story as well to get to him finally.
So Swami Satyananda, he had already left Bihar School of Yoga. He's the founder of Bihar School of Yoga. He had already left Munger, where the Bihar School of Yoga is established. And he was living in a small village close to Devghar, which is now in Jharkhand, one of the Shiva temple town. And he had closed his doors. He said that I am not a guru anymore and I don't want any disciples. But in my mind, I was clear that he is my guru and I cannot take anybody else. So after my engineering, I appeared for some of the MBA exam, business management, and I cleared a couple of interviews also in Pune and Mumbai, some good colleges. And around that time, there was this big convention, yoga convention in Munger, and I had no idea that who was in charge of Bihar School of Yoga after Swami Satyananda left. So I received this message letter from the Raipur ashram saying that there'll be a big convention and you can go and attend the program. Head of different traditions will come and they'll talk on yoga philosophy, yoga practices. So my initial reaction was that I'm not interested in yoga philosophy. And then later I thought about it and I said, okay, I will go only if I can work as a karma yogi, as seva. So he figured out and then I was able to go. And that's when I met the head of the Bihar School of Yoga at that time. And I felt that, okay, through him I can reach my guru. So I accepted and I took that little winding route to reach Swami Satyananda. And then it was just like it was supposed to happen. And I could be with Swami Satyananda for 14 years of my ashram life. So I was living in Munger, but every year for 4 to 5 months, I would be in his place in Rikhya in his ashram. And I got a direct understanding of what sannyas is from him. So it was all his blessings. And the Guru Kripa just opened up.
For people who don't have a direct guru, it's very difficult to understand. If you can give us a glimpse of any experience with him or just anything that springs to mind with your guru, it would be so nice if you could
share. This kind of connection and surrender towards the guru, it's special. It cannot just happen if you think logically too much. So that connection just opened up, and I received some direct guidance from Swami Satyananda ji. And then he was like a father and mother and a friend. So that is very special, because it was not that he was trying to keep himself on a high pedestal, that I am your guru. He had himself said, I am not guru anymore, and I don't want to have any disciples. But very caring, loving, and the guidance I received from him was incredible, not just in a kind of a direct verbal information, but sitting in his satsangs. And then I was also driving him around many times. The experience with the guru is always like he is your father, your mother, he is your best friend. So that kind of connection and that kind of surrender that comes when you dedicate yourself to guru, that is special. That opens up kind of all aspects of your personality. And he was there. He was there always taking care with a loving approach. And also sometimes when he had to teach something, not through words, then it was through his actions. So a lot of learning from him.
You mentioned that he really taught you what the meaning of sannyas is. You spent 14 years with him just learning. And then you were telling us about how this path of a sannyasi is, you spend some time with your guru and then you move away from the ashram. So if you could, one, take us through these steps of a sannyasi. Yeah. And also, it must have been, so like you said, the teacher is your, like your father, mother, brother, and then leaving him must have been scary, you know, challenging.
You see, I am guided by a lot of inner psychic experiences. And the role of guru, the meaning of guru is one who removes the darkness to bring in the light. And then that guru has to, in a real sense, help to activate your inner guru. So tradition says that there are four different stages in sannyas life. First is 12 years you spend with your guru, and 12 years is also one full circuit of Jupiter around the sun.
Planet guru.
Yeah, planet guru or Jupiter. 12 years is the cycle of Guru, Jupiter, in its orbit around the sun. And 12 years, according to tradition, is also the time we spend with the Guru to experience life and human perspective, psychology, over 12 years. So that's a good experience and good learning process. So I spent 12 years of my sannyas life, because I came and within a few months I was initiated straight away into Swami order. And then the second stage is you go into wandering stage, which is called Parivrajak. So Parivrajak is when the Guru Kripa really opens up in your life if you are focused on the path. And in Parivrajak you are reaching out to the world. So you have to learn the way of the world and also keep your own focus on the spiritual path. So that's a very challenging and also very interesting and very fulfilling stage. Because people can live in the ashram. It's a kind of a secure environment, and you don't have to worry about any paperwork or travel or taxes, anything. And we are provided with the food and the clothes that we need, and everything is provided, taken care of. But that is not the real purpose of sannyas. Sannyas means you become a trustee of yourself. You become trustee of everything that exists in the world. And then you share the beauty, the knowledge, the wisdom, and you help others to connect to the spiritual path. So ashram is always like a good place for people to come to, but not everybody can come to ashram. So in Parivrajak stage, you are supposed to travel and reach out to the world, to the people. And then the third stage, after a few years of wandering, when people feel that, okay, they can support this wandering yogi or swami, then they help to set up an ashram. Because for Swami, ashram is not a personal necessity. Ashram is a necessity from the spiritual purpose that we have to go out and share the information, the knowledge, the wisdom with the world. So then people come together and they help the Swami with donation or with land, and then the ashram setup comes in. So the third stage is ashram, and I am slowly now moving into that stage because I have land in a forested area in Madhya Pradesh. So hopefully later this year, we'll be able to start the process of setting up an infrastructure there. And the fourth stage is that I help to set up the ashram, and then I train somebody who can take care of that ashram. And then I leave the ashram and follow my own spiritual journey towards the later part of life. So these are the four stages. First with the guru, second in the wandering stage, third is settle down and set up an ashram, a spiritual center, so people can come and learn from you. And fourth is train somebody properly and leave the ashram in care of that person, and then withdraw from all the active worldly life, because even that trying to set up an ashram is still a worldly involvement, and to move into sannyas life at the highest level. So there are different names to this four stages. The first stage with the guru is called Kichak. Then the wandering stage is called Bahudak. Then the ashram stage is called Hamsa. And then finally, when the person leaves everything and focuses on his or her own sadhana, and without any even the idea that I am a guru or I have disciples, but just with oneself, that is called Paramhamsa. So these are the four stages.
I still keep going back to your path. So wasn't there any doubt when you decided that you want to go and learn with a teacher? Were you always very clear that you're going to be a sannyasi? You didn't think of, you'll have a family or...
Let me tell you clearly that I did not aspire or had any ambition of becoming a sannyasi. I did not know what that was. And I met this Swami in the Raipur ashram, and I saw that, okay, this is a way of life also. And when I came to Swami Satyananda, to Bihar School of Yoga, my mind was clear that I want to serve him. I had the feeling, deep feeling, that he has guided me in this spiritual journey so nicely, so beautifully. And I could not see his face till I met him, or I saw that picture in that piece of paper. So in my mind, it was, I have to serve this guru who has guided me so much. So it was not a desire to become this or that, but just to serve the guru. And I did not even go through any sannyas training, because when I got initiated in 1995, just few months before, after I came to ashram, there were other disciples who were there for 6 to 11 years, and they had gone through a lot of training, and then they got initiated. So there was no desire to become a Swami as such. The desire was to serve my guru.
And then the bigger desire is to serve yoga, isn't it?
And yes, teach. And then the guru, you see, there are many different gurus we have who can teach you different aspects of, let's say, yoga, spiritual life, meditation, or philosophy as such. But then there is one Sadguru. Sadguru is one who is the true guru. And not necessarily that he teaches you anything, but Sadguru is one who just gives you your life purpose and direction.
Since we are talking about life purpose and direction, in your opinion, what is the purpose of human life for anybody? And anybody, I mean, in your case, it's very clear, but any layperson like me.
So in the Upanishads, we find a beautiful answer to that. And I'll quote from two different Upanishads. First is Ishavasya Upanishad. The very opening shloka, it says, Ishavasyam idam sarvam, that this whole world is pervaded by this divine consciousness. Whatever is living and whatever is inanimate, everything is pervaded by the divine consciousness. And then it says, this is for your enjoyment, but enjoy without getting attached to anything. So this is the way of life. You enjoy everything in life, but don't get attached, don't become possessive. And that is why the sannyas tradition says you become sannyasi, samyak rupena nyastam iti sannyastam. That you become a true trustee of everything that you interact with, including your body, your mind. You are a trustee, you are not an owner. Including the things in this world, you are a trustee, you are not an owner. So then you create a nice kind of a dharmic relation, that you set an kind of a quality of harmony inside, outside, with the objects and with your own feelings. And then the true purpose of life that we find in Chandogya Upanishad, and it has been referred in other Upanishads also, for example, Brihad Aranyaka Upanishad, it says, Asato ma sadgamaya, that the journey should be from the unreal to the real. Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, from darkness to light. Mrityor ma amritam gamaya, from mortality to realizing the immortal self within. So that is the true and the highest purpose of life. In that journey, whatever you do in the middle, it's like, okay, you are on a train journey from point A to point B. Now, while you are on the train, what you do, read a newspaper, or you take a nap, or you read a magazine, or you eat some peanuts, or you chat up with your neighbors, this is all part of your life experience, and you should enjoy it without getting attached. So that's why I'm quoting from two different beautiful sources. But the highest purpose is, of course, to find the real from all this illusion, to figure out what is that reality.
Also, Swamiji, when you were telling us about your psychic experiences, you've had very clear experiences with, you know, this other dimension of humanity. Most of us are only stuck in this sharir, physical, eating, drinking, whatever. and for all of us, even if, let's say, we had a glimpse of an experience or a feeling, we think, ah, it's a feeling, you know, don't it may not be true. How true are these chakras, koshas? They're so fascinating for anybody who hasn't experienced it. It's like, oh, wow. But how can a lay person come in contact with these and just be more sensitive to these energies?
That's a good question, because this is what brought me into the path. And I realized a lot of things under my guru's guidance. And now there are a lot of tools that show you your energy field, your aura field, your chakras. And science is moving from the material consciousness into the energy consciousness. And behind the energy is just the pure consciousness. So this energy and consciousness phenomena, we experience in our body, in our mind, in our prana, the energy movement, but we don't see beyond it, because when it becomes subtle, we start doubting it. Like if I ask, where is your mind? I normally ask people, where is your mind? Can you see it? The mind is subtle. We process everything through the mind, but we don't exactly know where the mind is. People point here, I say, that's your hardware, that's the brain. Is the hardware that is doing all the energy movement, but mind is like a software. Similarly, the chakras, they are like inner softwares. So the most beautiful understanding in yoga is the panchakoshas, the five dimensions of our being. We know our physical body because we invest a lot of our awareness, a lot of our energy into this physical dimension. The next dimension is called the energy body. Without energy, we cannot function in the body and the mind. So energy we experience through our breath, through the kind of food that we eat, through the interaction we have in the world. So there is the physical part of it, oxygen and other gases. So we are at the next level of human understanding. Earlier, we believed in everything that Newton said. So that was the material dimension. And then quantum physics came. So now we are looking more from the energy perspective. And the next dimension, of course, is the consciousness that the yogis have discovered, but science cannot speak about it because it's not measurable within the scientific parameters or through the instruments. So I experienced the chakras, I experienced the energy movement of Kundalini and all that. And now there are machines. that can show you your aura field, that can show you your power of the chakras, or if the mind has a negative thought, how the chakras, they kind of protect you by closing in. So all these gadgets, tools, machines are available now. And what I'm saying is that the most beautiful philosophy, which is very practical, because you see, yoga is always a practical approach to life, practical approach to spirituality. So it's not just some kind of mental gymnastics. Yoga helps us to understand everything and then transcend. So we are made up of five bodies, the panchakoshas. The first is the physical dimension. This physical dimension is where we invest a lot of our energy. Our mind goes into the physical body, the physical look we have, the physical desires we have through the senses. But that is just the gross dimension. The second dimension is energy dimension. Energy is the prana at its subtle level. In a physical level, we talk of oxygen and other gases. But at subtle level, it is the pranic energy, the fundamental life force. Now, this energy body, it is subtle. We do not see it, but we can still feel it through our breath, through our nostrils. The third is even more subtle. That is the mental body. This mental body works with the inner instruments of the primary mind, and then the ego, and then intellect, and also the memory field, the individual consciousness. So this is so subtle. We use the instruments which are subtle. They are not physical in nature. For example, ego. Is ego physical in nature? Ego can take on any form. But in reality, it is not something physical. It's not a physical identity. When I connect with my body, my ego takes on this physical identity with the body. When I connect with an emotion, my ego takes on the feeling or that emotion as its identity. For example, if I say I am happy. Now, happiness is an emotion. That emotion is not something physical, but its effects are on the physical body. So we are talking of more subtle. Most of the time, we are lost in these three dimensions, the physical, the energy, and the mental. Because the energy dimension we use in our sensual desires, in fulfilling our basic instincts. So that energy gets depleted and we don't have access to the fourth dimension. This is where the understanding of the chakras, the true wisdom of who we are in connection with this universe, what is our purpose and what we can do best in this life to add to the beauty and to the, let's say, the dharma of the world. And the fifth dimension is, we call the ananda. Anandamaya Kosh. That is our true fundamental nature. This is how the energy kind of vibrates from the most subtle to the gross, and it comes as the physical body. We get lost in the mind, and that's why we cannot transcend beyond the mind into the Vijnanamaya Kosha, the wisdom dimension, the psychic dimension. And then we are lost in our own identity of who am I and what is my life purpose. And this is why so much confusion arises, and then we say it's all an illusion. But this mind, which is a versatile instrument, has to be trained properly, and then finally it has to be made calm. Then we look into the chakras. So through many experiences, through a lot of meditation, when I experienced it, and then later I saw that science is also developing instruments and tools by which we can understand the chakras, we can look at their energy, we can look at their alignment. So we are moving into this energy awareness, and that's I would call it that's a major quantum leap in understanding ourselves beyond the physical body.
Nice elaborate answer. So while we were talking about you know, the energetic fields, etc., but you also do these retreats in all these various energy centers. In that energy dimension, if you could talk a bit about these divine centers, maybe where you take people on tours, as well as the these dharmic places.
Yeah. So you see, we are an energy principle. Our body, our mind, they are all vibrating with energy. So we set our own energy pattern, and this is how our personality, our mind gets defined. So we set up an energy field, and that has our imprint. If our energy is in tune with somebody else's energy, we feel nice with that person or in a certain place. But there are certain places which have very high energy vibration, and I would call them spiritual. Spiritual in the sense that they help us come back to our own true center. So one is the sensual that pulls us out, and another is spiritual that brings you back in. So this is the kind of friction between the path of Maya and the path of Leela. So involution from cosmic consciousness down to matter, and evolution back to understanding who we are in our true self. And yoga is a path of evolution. So sometimes we need a stronger energy to wash out our energy pattern that we have created out of our anxiety and out of our memories, out of our wrong projections, or out of our belief system. And then if you are feeling contracted, if you are feeling that you are lost, if you feel that you don't have a clear sense of purpose and direction, then it's a good idea to go on this kind of retreats or pilgrimages where you can meet up with a higher energy vibration. And then just think of it like you are getting a bath. Now, this higher energy vibration is washing out all the energy pattern that you have created that is kind of psychosomatic problems, or problem with your belief system, problem with your purpose of life. So when this energy washes out your energy pattern, then you again open up to that spiritual path inside that will give you that satisfaction, that will give you a better understanding of your dharma and what kind of karmas will help you evolve. So it's all interlinked, and that's why it's always a good idea to go to this kind of energy places. And the mystics and the yogis, they have identified many of them. So those are called, for example, the Jyotirling. We have 12 Jyotirlinga Shiva temples in India. They are very high energy vibrations. And because for thousands of years, the mantra chant and the special worship and the waving of the light, the arati keeps on happening. So the energy field is definitely expanded and powerful. Then we have so many Shakti peaks, the Shakti temples. And then just as we have chakras in the body, there are chakras on earth. So mystics know how the energy is flowing through the earth as a living organism. So for example, we have the crown chakra here at the top of the head. So on earth, the crown chakra is Mount Kailash. And even people who are living in South America, the shamans, they also believe that they are at the tail end of the kundalini of earth, and Kailash is as the is the head end, the crown chakra. The root chakra is in Mount Shasta in California. All the mystics, they believe that. So I visited all these seven energy places, also seven chakras of earth. I go to Mount Kailash almost every year because that's like a supercharging station. And then you are just flowing with life, with good energy. Otherwise, with our mental thought patterns and confusions and belief system, we kind of close ourselves in, and we create the limitations, we create delusions, and then that is not helpful to evolve further. Suddenly we are kind of locked in. So going to these energy places will kind of unlock your mind. So it's not only the energy centers of the chakras or the Shiva temple, they are beautiful energy places on earth which are filled with natural beauty, which are beautiful because some mystic or some yogi lived in that place. So I take people on such pilgrimages and yoga adventures. Like I take people on Peru, because Peru is related to the second chakra, the sacral chakra, from Machu Picchu and Lake Titicaca. I have taken people to Egypt, to the pyramids, and we have done mantra chant inside the big temple, the big pyramid. Then I have taken people to Iceland, because in Iceland, the earth is coming out. It's a volcanic island. So it's like fresh earth coming out. So you connect with the fresh earth element there, and the nature itself is beautiful. Then I take people to Antarctica because it's kind of like untouched energy place. So it's already full of a very high intense energy, not disturbed by the human interaction too much. And then when you go to such places, your mind just opens up into a new understanding, a new perspective.
So just like these energy places, Swamiji, there's also all the elements that are always working with your energy. So for example, you were telling us about how you should always have the Tirtha at, the water, that the sacred water that you're given as Tirtha in the temples. So if you could talk a bit about water, but also other elements, how do you make use of these elements, but also how do you protect yourself? Because I'm sure just as a positive, there's also a negative, I'm assuming.
The positive and the negative, they coexist, and they are there to create that churning. And this churning is eternal. It's kind of happening always. So it's not something mythological that the yogis talked about, this churning of the ocean of milk. The ocean of the milk is like our own mind, and then a mind can think positive, it can also think negative, it can go either way. And to keep the mind focused and cleared and in the light and not in the darkness, the yogis and the rishis, they gave us certain tools that have over time become rituals. For example, when you go to the temples in India or any temple, Hindu temple, you receive just a little bit of water as prasad that you take. Now, that water is supercharged with the energy of the mantra and the arati, the waving of the lights. So, water is a beautiful element. It's a cleansing element, and it's also responsible for life itself. This is how life came about, because of water element. We are thinking of going to Moon and Mars, but the first condition is how we can have water there. We are looking for water. And our own physical body is made up of around 65 to 70% water by weight. So water is a very pervasive element in our system on Earth. I think 71% of Earth is water, the Earth's surface. So water carries memory. Whatever you imprint on water, it carries that memory. And one Japanese doctor had done a research, so he had different samples of water and he gave them different vibrations through emotions, like holding one water and saying that I love you, you are beautiful, and then freezing it. Another sample, he said, you are ugly and evil, and then freezing that water. And then another, that you are divine and blissful, freezing that. And then he saw the crystals of the frozen water that were given different emotions. All the crystals are different in shape, where he infused water with positive emotions, with the happy emotions. The water crystals are beautiful, just beautiful to look at. Where he said, water, that you are ugly, or where he expressed that I don't like you, or he expressed anger on water, the crystals are not even formed clearly, or they look ugly. They are not kind of a regular form. So, if around 70% of our system is water, then this is the best element to work with. And the yogis and the rishis and the priests, they knew this. So, water was always one of the important element, either when you are doing any havan or a big yajna, fire ceremony. You keep the water in the pot, and then you have this mango leaves and then a coconut. So that water gets charged. In the temple, when you go, there is just a small copper pot, or sometimes a silver pot, and a tiny spoon, not even a teaspoon, and you get that as prasad, and you drink, and then so water becomes a beautiful tool. And we always have, in the Indian system, we have this tradition of saying some mantra before we eat food. So before you drink water, before you eat food, it's always a good idea to charge that with some mantras, Mantras are not some wishful thinking. Mantras are received in deep meditation. So those are powerful energy patterns that you can imprint on water as an intention. And then you can work wonders with water. So not just energy places, but in your own home, you can do this.
So each of us can perhaps say some chant, some mantra near the water and drink it. And
yes, exactly. There are universal mantras like the Gayatri mantra, Mahamrityunjaya mantra. They are very good. But if you have a specific problem, then you should ask a guru, get initiated. And if you look at Durga Saptasati, the book of chants related to Goddess Durga, normally if it's printed from Gita Press, at the end you find collection of mantras for different use. So if somebody has a problem with a mental dimension, then there is a mantra taken from the Durga Saptasati and said that this mantra, even for pandemic, they have mantra to protect people from pandemic, to protect people from any kind of disease, to protect people from any kind of legal problems. So there are different mantras, but one should receive it from initiation, because then the mantras have more power and then they become effective tool for change and transformation.
So I wanted to ask you about, in Marathi, we say Purvajanchi Punyai, which means that whatever your good deeds your Purvaj have done, your ancestors have done, that sort of affects your life, and that probably brings I'm talking more about the good than the bad, but brings the good things in your life are perhaps because of your ancestors. What's your experience with that, and you know, what's your perception, your knowledge around that?
I also thought about this, and I feel that we are working with three different kinds of memories in our life. One is the genetic memory. So that's definitely coming from your Purvaj, right? So that genetic memory and the health and your structure and a lot of things at physical level and physiological level, it comes through the genes. The second is the karmic memory, which is very personal. What you as an individual have experienced through many lives to come to this level of understanding or suffering because of the past karma, so that is karmic memory. And third is the psychological memory that we kind of build up from this life when we are born. So we are taught, if I'm born in a different country and different religion, then I'll be imprinted with those kind of psychological memories. I'm born in India, so I'm born with a belief system from the parents, and then those kind of memories are building up in my psychological dimension. So these three memories, so definitely the Purvaj are there because of the genetic memory, because the genes carry a lot of information in a very subtle way. Then the karmic memory, which is my personal individual soul that has traveled through many lives to come to this level of understanding, and good or bad karmas, I am responsible for my own life, so my life is my responsibility. And third is psychological memory. What to do with all the memories that I have collected in this life, and that kind of stirs up my mind from time to time. That is also my responsibility. But we need guidance. From time to time, we need guidance. And that's why Guru becomes a very important person. Now, not necessarily that Guru has to be a human being, because in the tradition of Tantra, we believe Lord Dattatreya as one of the highest yogi. And he did not have any human guru. He had 24 gurus, but none of them was a human person in human body. So guru is one who opens up your mind, your perception towards higher reality. So be open to receive, because at one point you asked that we do get those glimpses or intuition, but we don't listen to it. And this is where the energy drops back to our basic instincts and desires. And then we are caught in that whirlpool of instincts and desires. And that is Maya. But in the same whirlpool, if we create an upward movement, then it just opens up into the path of evolution. And yoga is the best tool for that, for evolution.
Wonderful. So another one of the things that you do, Swamiji, is you also delve into astrology. So with that in mind, what do you think is the future of yoga?
I did not believe in astrology myself earlier on. But then by chance, one of the astrologer lady from Nepal, she read my chart. And I was astonished that how come she knows, just looking at those symbols and what degree they are in, what signs and what houses they are in. And then I started taking interest. And then I found that it's a fascinating science. It's a probability-based science. And intuition also has to work. So I started doing astrology. It's not my profession. I started doing astrology to help people when they are in a critical junction or when they are in some kind of, let's say, psychological support they need. Then astrology also becomes a wonderful tool. Looking at, I cannot see directly into yoga, but I can see into like countries, India. The growth story is beautiful. India is always like a spiritual hub. And yoga is a universal science again. Yoga and Tantra was universal, I believe, because we find some symbols in the Mayan and the Aztec and the Egyptian culture that indicates that people knew something of the esoteric or the occult. So that was always there, but it's the beauty of Indian tradition that in Bharat, in India, we preserved the tradition through the guru-disciple relationship. So the knowledge has traveled without any interruption. So we are still connected to that uninterrupted flow of knowledge and wisdom from our gurus, from our rishis. So yoga has become universal again. And in whatever way you people connect to yoga, I think it's a good starting point. And then eventually some of them will look for the roots. They'll look for the right answer. They'll look for the higher meaning and purpose of yoga. And that's how it should be.
Thank you, Swamiji. Is there anything that you would like to say that we maybe haven't covered?
I can quote a couple of things from Srimad Bhagavad Gita and also Yoga Sutras.
That would be great.
If you look at yoga as science, is the science of mind management. So it's the art and the science of mind management. And that we see in the dialogue between Krishna and Arjun, that it's about how to deal with your own mind. So you are sorted, and then whatever you do within your own dharma, within your own field of karma, you should be in a state of balance, harmony, equipoise. So samatvam yoga uchyate, that is the first definition of yoga in Srimad Bhagavad Gita. And we know that Arjun went through a state of dejection and he felt that he started feeling that attachment to things, to his own ideas. And then Krishna had to break all that. And Krishna said that, look, yogastha kuru karmani, whatever you do, all your karmas be established in yoga. Sangam tyaktva dhananjaya. And this is also from the Upanishads, from Ishavasya Upanishad. Ishavasya Upanishad says, Ten tyaktena bhunjitha. Enjoy this world. It's for your enjoyment. Enjoy it, but with tyag, not getting attached. So Krishna also says the same thing. And then he says, Siddh asiddhya samo bhutva. Whether you are successful or not, samatvam yog uchyate. So that balance, harmony, equipoise, that is yoga. People think that by doing some difficult asanas in some funny place or a nice nature, they have become yogi. No. If your mind has come to that state of balance and equipoise, then you are a yogi. And second thing I would like to quote from the Yoga Sutras, it's a beautiful textbook. Again, mind management. The definition of yoga there is yogas chitta vritti nirodha. How you handle your mind to make it calm and still, that is yoga. And there, it gives us the clue of what should be the approach so you can manage your mind better. You can manage your life better. It says abhyas and vairagya, daily practice and non-attachment. Vairagya means not to allow your mind to be colored by the experiences. It's like putting the emotions and the experiences and the feelings in the right place without getting attached into positive or negative. And then for Abhyas, it says, Satu Dirghakal Nirantarya Satkara Sevito Drid Bhumi, that your practice in yoga or whatever you have accepted as part of your spiritual journey, it should be Nirantarya, for a long time without any break. Dirghakal and Nirantarya, long time without any break, and with a positive attitude. So don't do your yoga practices in a mechanical way. Invest your time, because the return that you get from your daily yoga is not measurable in any worldly parameters. It will guide you into the highest experience. So keep the balance and harmony in your life. Keep an equipoise state of mind. And also be sincere and regular with your daily yoga practice, little meditation if you can bring in. And if you need guidance, then seek the masters, the wisdom keepers. Take guidance from them so your memories, your aspirations, your ambitions, they find a higher purpose. Then your life journey will be towards light, not dealing with the darkness. So that's my message taken from the classical sources.
It's such a nice place to end and such a positive place to end because, of course, we start with yoga and end with yoga. So, thank you very much, Swamiji. Thank you.
Thank you,
Thank
Sujata ji. I enjoyed this interview. You had
you.
good questions. Hari Om.
Thank
Sure.
you. Thank you so much,
Okay,
Swamiji.
ji. Namaste. Hari Om.